Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, and hope everybody is having a very happy Memorial Day weekend. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The U.S. COVID death toll is now at nearly 595,000, as about 70% of the nation is vaccinated. And this is the first major holiday resembling a sense of normalcy, with air travel figures approaching what they were before the pandemic began in March 2020. Many continue to wear face masks as sporting events and other venues reopen. That said, there are concerns that the spread of a more virulent COVID strain, such as the Indian one, could prove devastating to parts of the world that have so far avoided the brunt of the pandemic, hampering a worldwide recovery. The Biden administration has made public its $6 trillion budget request to Congress, of which $715 billion is for defense. Research and development, as well as classified spending, are up, as acquisition spending is down slightly. Qatar CEO Akbar Al-Bakr is continuing his feud with Airbus as the jetmaker commits to ramping up production, and Boeing agrees to a $17 million settlement over the 737 and again suspends 787 manufacturer. Dassault has sold Rafale jets to Croatia to replace Zagreb's F-16s, and General Motors and Lockheed Martin have agreed to partner to build the latest lunar rover, returning the American car maker to the moon. The last three Apollo missions carried GM-made lunar excursion rovers. Joining us to discuss all that and more, as they do every week, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us, and hope you're all having a very happy Memorial Day, including you, Sash, where it's a bank holiday in the United Kingdom.
Vago, thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you very much indeed, Vago. Happy Whitsun to you.
Happy Memorial Day, Vago, and to all.
Two of us have cicadas that are in the background, so even from my studio, I can hear them, and I don't know whether the audience, so just apologies, because if you have enough of them, as Richard and I do where we live, it does sound rather an ear-splitting roar outside. Before we get started, Leonardo DRS.
I've got something so much better than that. I've got a search and rescue. Augusta Westland 189 has just come in right over the cottage to rescue somebody from the cliffs.
Oh, wow. Well, yes. Okay. Not once in a 17-year occurrence, but still, nonetheless, an absolutely fantastic sound. Before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global
site as well. It's lovely. Raspberry it Ripple, is. white and red. That's a great site.
Absolutely terrific. And let me get our sponsors out. Before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. Everybody, welcome. Sash, keep us posted on the rescue that's going on the cliffs from where you're sitting, clearly in Wales and not in downtown London, clearly.
Yeah, there are very, very few cliffs in London, I'm glad to say.
Yeah, unless you're at the top of the Shard, would be it. Ron, start us off, right? Talk to us a little bit about the broader market as the nation gets back to normal, but also your thoughts on the administration's defense budget, which is clearly going to be something that is going to be occupying folks, not just on the market, but elsewhere. And a note to our listeners, all week long, we're going to be doing deeper dives on Navy, Air Force, and Army, and cyber elements of this budget. But why don't you start us off on where the market's head is, and your sense on the budget. And Richard, would love to get your sense as well, because there's quite a lot of aeronautical news, broader news, but certainly aeronautical news in this. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, sure. So on the week, commercial aerospace was up. I mean, the bellwether for that really, really is Boeing. The Dow Jones was up maybe about 0.5% on the week. Boeing was up about 4.5%. Leading the market. The other aero names were somewhere between you know, kind of in line with the Dow or above. The defense stocks on the week were down. They underperformed the market, but not by a lot. They were down maybe 0.5%. You know, when the budget dropped, we didn't see much of a reaction from the defense stocks. But to be clear, that could be because it was the beginning of a long weekend. So I'm not sure how many people were around to actually look at the budget, but we didn't see much of a reaction. Inflation fears are still percolating around the market as indicators are coming back inflation is still a concern. The 10-year treasury is still hovering around 1.6 and change in that range, but somewhere between 1.6 and 1.7. So not much of a change there. We've been keeping an eye on passengers going through the TSA, and we're just a hair under 2 million. I guess it was sort of a bet I had with somebody. Would we break 2 million or not? We almost did, but we didn't. So I think that was maybe 500,000 or 600,000 below where we were the same time last year. When you look at the defense budget, I would say just kind of quickly at a high level, and I know we're going to dig down more. I mean, it seems like the winners were shipbuilding, especially subs. C4I, especially information security and assurance and tech development. Microelectronics funding there was up 50%. Space support and science and technology are up. It seems like on the flip side, aircraft and some missile defense so that's an area where it doesn't seem like the funding was as strong. Conventional ammunition, space technology development were down a bunch from a year ago. I think, just one interesting takeaway, when you look at the major defense acquisition programs, the big guys, they were about 30% of the modernization budget, down from 36% a year ago, and 78 of the 85 reported programs of the MDAPs were down 9% year over year. So the big programs in general didn't fare as well as some of the smaller, and obviously that kind of dovetails with the money being spent on R&D. But smaller programs seem to do better than large programs, and there was some interesting things going on in aviation, like for example, F-18 not getting funded, and then some other programs in terms of their funding levels. Like F-18, I think was down 86%, B-22 was down 35%, P-8 was down 86%, and Tanker was down 11%. So anyway, that's just some initial thoughts.
Richard, what's your sense?
Well, it's sort of interesting. I don't know whether this is intentional or unintentional by the Biden administration, but I think this actually sets us up for the mother of all increased defense budgets going through the congressional process, because as Ron and you've noted, it really heavily emphasizes RDT&E and, of course, transformational programs and black programs. Those are all the programs that nobody in Congress really spends a lot of time adding cash to. And a lot of the funding for that increase has come from exactly the places that Congress likes to add cash to, particularly Super Hornets. Super Hornets made it most of the last decade with no requested money till Trump came along. And before that, it was always congressionally added. And there's going to be some fans of NAVAIR who add money for F-18s. Similarly, for F-35s, it'll be punished terribly by only having, 8 or a dozen added rather than 18 or something. And then on top of that, you've got the enormous battle that we're setting up for in terms of several hundred retired aircraft, including 4 J-STARS. That is absolutely radioactive. Ditto for the 42, I believe, A-10 retirements. In other words, the places that they're paying for this increase in R&D are all the places that Congress is almost guaranteed, like catnip, to add cash to. So I think we're actually going to see a significant increase to this request come out of the budget cycle at the end of this.
So your sense is that as opposed to ending up at 715, there is going to be more money ultimately in the budget in order to cover all of these things that are being traded off to get headroom to invest in new programs, right? So your sense is the new programs survive, and these legacy programs make it through as well in some form.
That's right. It's going to be kind of the reverse. You know, I doubt it was intentional, but the Trump folks prioritized procurement and force structure, but that left not a lot of argument for Congress to add even more. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't, but they never really had to fight a battle to prevent a couple hundred, you know, aircraft being retired. In this case, it's easy to see the battle being set up to insert more cash, and it is very unlikely that that additional cash will come out of the hide of those new transformational programs in our DT&E accounts.
Sash, look, and one thing I should point out, right, that this has been a progression in some of these leap ahead programs that got started by the Obama administration, were supported by the Trump administration, and are now being picked up by the Biden administration, whether it's in hypersonics, whether it's in cyber and 5G AI and all of that, right? I mean, those were all have really been found, you know, machine learning and all of that have been key elements of this. Before we go to the commercial conversation, Sash, what's your sense of this? Because you're a pretty astute observer of defense spending, no matter where it is, whether it's in the UK, you know, Croatia or the United States. What's your sense on absorbing what it is we're doing over here and your thoughts?
I think the process of canceling mature or, you know, cutting mature programs to pay for new program, to pay for new and particularly new technology, that's something that is, you know, feels terribly familiar on this side of the Atlantic. I think what is fascinating, though, is when that process has a collateral implications for ongoing international competitions. And I saw the zero funding of the F-18 and my jaw dropped. The F-18 is in three major international, probably the three largest international fighter competitions we've seen in a very, very long time. Finland, Switzerland, Canada. And so to zero fund the aircraft at the most sensitive stage of those three programs, it just sends the most bizarre signal. And I've got a question for you, which is, you know, can the US or can Boeing maintain their pricing for those aircraft if the US has zero funded it? Or indeed, if, as Richard suggests, plus ups mean that F-18 comes back as an 8 aircraft purchase rather than 18 aircraft purchase. It seems to me that, you know, that's a real case of pulling the rug out from under the US, or, you know, that particular US bid at the most difficult stage of the contest. Now, you know, it may be that that's then good for the F-35, certainly for those three programs. And therefore, the US administration doesn't terribly care. But I think to, you know, take out the aircraft that is certainly running, you know, on our estimates, in the lead in Finland, probably, you know, is a strong contender in Switzerland, that, you know, that's bizarre.
From the administration standpoint, right, they plussed up the F-35 despite all the criticism that was going on. And there is this sense that the F-18 was something that is the happy place for the Navy. Congress was always making money available for it, and so they kept buying it. And at this point, the administration was like, look, it doesn't really make sense to be buying a lot of fourth generation airplanes at this point, right? I mean, the F-15 EX got dialed back as well a little bit. Ron, I know you want to weigh on this before we go into the rest of the discussion. Well, I mean, so from a pricing perspective, Richard, maybe you're the best. Richard and Ron, answer Sasha's pricing question. And then Ron, why don't you wrap us up with on the budget discussion with your thoughts?
Yeah, I must take objection to Sasha's argument for the simple reason that Boeing has gotten really good at keeping things pretty constant on the pricing front with just one over one per month on the Super Hornet. What export customers want is a hot line. And the reasoning for the budget, not including F-18s, is right now the line is plenty hot for the next couple of years because they're filling the Kuwaiti orders. And therefore, there's absolutely no pressing reason to keep things going with the traditional 14 or 18 planes.
Ron?
Yeah. You know, I would also say this, because you alluded to this earlier. You know, there is some budget gaming going on too, right? I mean, the administration budget isn't the budget that's enacted in the law, right? It has to go through the entire process. And in the process, things are definitely changed, added, subtracted, so on and so forth, right? So many of these programs, you'll see things added to for sure. And if you look at the verbiage in the budget, they were clear that, you know, we want to work with Congress and you know, to kind of, how can I say, gently, feather away from some of the legacy programs. So I think this is their first ask, but there's going to be a counter ask and back and forth, obviously, right? So clearly, in the end, are they really going to buy no F-18s? That seems hard to believe, right? I think that's how it's going to play out. And then another thing I might add, I thought was interesting. There was an increase in the budget for cyber and defense, but there was a bigger increase in the budget for cyber for non-defense at the federal level, right? I think, cyber was up maybe 6% for defense, but was up, I think, 14 or 15% for non-defense. So, there's a push in that area too. And that can be significant for the services companies that, play in, the federal space a little bit, outside of just defense.
And were the shipbuilding numbers a surprise? I mean, a little bit lower than what certainly some navalists had expected from this administration that was or came to be regarded as being supportive of sea power. Was that a bit of a downer for anybody in the shipbuilding segment?
I think from a street perspective, no. I mean, the expectation was you were going to see strong growth in undersea, and that's what we saw. Right. And again, I mean, sort of broadly at a high level, anything that has to do with projecting power over long distances actually did pretty well, right? Particularly naval power. So yeah, I mean, I don't think that the street was negatively surprised by anything that came out there.
If we're all done with the defense part of it, Sash, I want to go to you to talk a little bit about commercial. DSEI is happening in person in London in September. A lot of excitement about that. Looks like Dubai Air Show is also going to be an in-person event. Certainly a lot of opening up across the board. UK returning back to normal or as normal as we can be. And Europe, even there is a sense that the situation isn't as dire as it was some weeks ago. Talk to us a little bit about travel, traffic, and Airbus's decision to boost production, right? I mean, and how realistic you guys think that goal is.
Just as far as, trade shows opening up, fantastic if it happens. I've got to say, given that the UK still has a 10-day quarantine for anybody coming into the country from anywhere but about a dozen other countries in the world, and I'm afraid the US is not one of those dozen at the moment. What's the overseas, how many overseas visitors are going to come? Fractionally small at the moment. It's been a really odd week for overall travel news, because on the one hand, vaccination rates in Europe are doing very well. There are some countries in Europe doing extremely well indeed. Germany, is really putting on a strong performance at the moment. Italy is doing very well as well. But on the other hand, France has imposed a complete travel ban on all travel from the UK. Well, we're the most vaccinated country in Europe, but they are worried about the so-called Indian variant, of which we have roughly 4,000 cases at the moment here. And so no travel to France at all. And I think the degree to which there is a disconnect at the moment between vaccination and hence the general health of the populace and our ability to travel freely, that's been one of the most concerning things about this week. The French travel ban really did, I think, take people quite by surprise. There may be something to be, maybe partly reflecting the fact that France has got one of the weakest performances on vaccination at the moment, and therefore they just don't want to let anything in. But the idea that, COVID passports are going to enable much freer travel is a hope, but it's certainly not being proved at the moment. So as far as Airbus is concerned, I mean, Airbus's statement last week that it's going to raise rates through 2025 to not just an all-time record, but so far beyond the previous record was, frankly, jaw-dropping. I mean, just to give you, you know, the key numbers, the A320 program, and the A320 is, you know, the category killer in the market. They're calling on their suppliers to increase rates by over 50% by mid-decade. So from the current 40-plus aircraft this year, they'll end the year at about 45, up to as high as 75 by 2025. They're talking about doubling rates for the A220, the old Bombardier C-Series. And so in total, if you, you know, add all of their numbers together, they're talking about a monthly production rate of 97 aircraft a month. That compares with the previous record in 2019 of 78 aircraft a month. And this has caused quite a lot of, frankly, surprise. Certainly suppliers we've talked to this week have been very, very surprised indeed, because they're not sure they can do that. But there's been a lot of pushback by some of the airlines, and in particular by Willie Walsh, who used to run IAG Group and now is Director General of IATA, who just pointed out that the airline industry is going to be smaller. The airline post-COVID, the airline industry globally is certainly financially much less stable. So it doesn't need this many aircraft. And I think there's, you know, the most interesting take conclusion that we can draw from this is that this is Airbus trying to, you know, almost impose the coup de grace on Boeing, because they're pushing rates up because they think they can. They know they've got the backlog. They're pretty sure that Boeing does not have the backlog to match them. And it will cause huge stress. And it will almost certainly cause stress, because if Boeing is going to match Airbus on this, they're going to have to cut prices to get the orders they need to, you know, to fill those rates. And that will make 737 a very, very unprofitable program, even if they get the production rate up. I think it's an astonishingly aggressive move by Airbus. Even if they don't get to these high rates, they clearly think they can start pushing the rate up significantly in 22. And, you know, what you've got here is the number one who, you know, intends to be a, you know, the number one for the decade. It's a, as I said, it's incredibly aggressive.
Richard?
Yeah, I agree completely, of course, with Sash, with one minor caveat. The 320 Neo is not the category killer. The 321 Neo is. So to a very great extent, we're not just talking about market requirements for this record level of production. We're also talking about their ability to rectify the production snafus at Hamburg, especially with the LR and XLR versions of the 321 Neo. And if they can actually do that, they can, you know, sort through the mess that's been made over there. And of course, stand up the second line they've announced in Toulouse, in addition to the auxiliary lines in Tianjin and Mobile, then yeah, they can do something resembling this plan, because arguably the 321 Neo and especially LR and XLR are the one plane that I think everyone is pretty intrigued by as, you know, the great fragmenter, and the plane most of all that Boeing simply refuses to do and would rather surrender 10 points of market share. Failure, as we've said this before, is very much an option, clearly, for Boeing. And until otherwise notified, we've got to assume they're going down the path of losing 10 points of market share. So yeah, it's an aggressive move, just as Sash says, but there's also some risk baked in. You know, it wasn't just Willie Walsh, it was also IATA that said, no way, there's no need for this. But on the other hand, I'm on the record saying that, you know, the traffic recovery will take place at least 15 months before IATA says it is. So I'm kind of a prisoner of my own words, and I'll stay on the optimistic side regarding the Airbus production rates. The only part I think we should take with a big grain of salt, Sash has mentioned this before, I've mentioned this before, I'm pretty sure Ron has too, there's absolutely no call for talking about these higher wide-body rates that they've posited. The world is awash in wide-bodies, they're cheap as anything, no evidence that they're going to be needed, especially since, frankly, their place is going to be taken in a lot of cases by the very same A321 Neo XLRs. So I narrow body, sure, wide bodies, nah.
Ron?
Yeah, maybe just a couple additional thoughts. One, if you look at the previous peak rate on narrow body production between Boeing and Airbus, and this is just rough numbers, that was about 1,200 aircraft in a given year. So if you look at the out-year Airbus forecast that, you know, Sash pointed out is over 90 airplanes per month, and you were to extrapolate that the next peak in narrow-body production would be, call it 14 to 1,500 airplanes in total at the next peak, that would, and if Airbus were to hit those numbers, that would relegate Boeing to less than 30% market share. So, you know, I think there's some telegraphing going on there for that. One, two. if I were in Airbus's seat, I don't know if I would do anything different, because they probably perceive they're in a position of strength over Boeing. So why not carry a big hammer and use it, at least, you know, symbolically, if they don't actually get to this plan. You know, and then I think a third point you got to think about, and again, I kind of, you know, focused on that more aspirational 2025 number, when they were talking 75 A320 family aircraft in a given month. If you were to say 10 to 15 of those are going to be A321 LRs and XLRs per month, then you're down to maybe 60, 55 to 60 of the more vanilla A320, if you will, if you want to call it that. And that number is maybe more digestible. And you have to bear in mind what we've talked about on many podcasts. Boeing doesn't, you know, the 757 is gone. Boeing doesn't really have a very viable aircraft to sell against, particularly the XLR. So if you think that Airbus is, you know, shipping an airplane into a segment of the market where they don't have competition from Boeing, like the same thing with the A220, Boeing doesn't compete there either. So, you know, the A220 and the A321 XLR in segments of the market that Boeing is not present, and you look at those numbers, you know, even though they're high, and at first I was like, wow, that's a big number, you can parse it out, and it's maybe more digestible. I mean, of course, I agree with everything everybody said, and those are they're big numbers. But if you think about Boeing being absent from segments, that's, you know, the synergy that you get by having a product line that goes from, call it 115 seats all the way up to 250 seats in the narrow body market.
Sash, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I mean, just to pick up on, you know, a point of Richard's, that, you know, the way that Airbus works, and I refer to it as the A320 because it's the A320 family. 318, now deceased, no RIP there. 319, 320, 321, you know, CEOs, NEOs, but it's all the same. It's the same assembly system. It's the same facilities generally, although there's a little bit of tailoring, and, you know, particularly in Hamburg. But Airbus doesn't terribly care whether you order an A320 or an A321, because you can switch your order up to about 9 months, possibly even less, before delivery. And so it's much more for them like, you know, different engine sizes on a car, because all they're doing is adding an extra bit of tube or taking a bit of extra tube away. And it's therefore, you know, in economic terms and in dealing with their suppliers, it's the volume of, quotes unquotes, A320s, 1920s, 21s, you know, LRs, XLRs, that they push through the overall system that matters in terms of their competitiveness and in terms of their costs and hence in terms of their pricing. And it's a phenomenally flexible system at high rates when customers, you know, don't want to make their minds up until, you know, a couple of quarters beforehand. And I think that's, you know, that's why I just refer to the whole lot as A320s. Worry about what mark they are literally when the things are delivered. And I think as far as volume is concerned, the 321s in general, 321 Neo, 321 LR, 321 XLR, and again, this is, you know, up to the XLR, this is just different engine sizes or trim. But those are probably, in the out years, more than 50% of deliveries. And I think that's why Airbus feels more confident about this. And, you know, what an awful position for Boeing to be in, not to be able to compete at, you know, head to head with the most in-demand aircraft in the market.
Let me very quickly, we've got a ton of other things I want to talk about, including the Rafale sale to Croatia to, again, to replace the country's MiG-21s. But I want to very quickly get your guys' take on vaccine certificates, right? EU pressing ahead to institute them. The American administration saying we're going to do nothing of the sort. And then the Lukashenko affair, where the Belarusian dictator directed at least one fighter aircraft to intercept a Ryanair flight between Athens and Vilnius, forcing the airplane to land under false auspices of a bomb threat to apprehend a Belarusian democracy activist and his girlfriend. I mean, you know, what should we think of these dueling dynamics and what they mean for air travel? If something, yes. If not, nothing. Thoughts? because the Russians are already retaliating, right? Putin has said, well, Air France, and a number, you know, Austrian can't operate from Russia, right? So if you punish my Belarusian little brother, I'm going to make life miserable for you. I think the easy answer is don't fly anywhere that takes you anywhere near Minsk, and certainly don't fly to Moscow, but that might not be an easy answer for some people.
From my standpoint, it's pretty straightforward. This is more evidence of a broader pattern of aviation ecosystem decoupling that's taking place between the West and the former commies and unfortunately China. It's happening on an industrial level. It's happening on an airline level. It's most of all now it seems to be happening on an airspace level. What's horrible is that what Lukashenko did, no matter how outrageous and disgusting, it wasn't technically completely illegal. They do have control of their airspace. And so I think we've been put on notice, stay the hell away. And if Russia, or rather the Putin government, wants to go down that path, that's unfortunate. But, you know, the world is kind of having to choose. Do you want an ecosystem, a political economy, whatever else, that looks like that? Or do you want something that isn't grotesquely uncivilized?
I think the problem with this is that it's not an issue of if you don't like it, don't fly near Minsk. If you decide that your airline should not fly near Minsk, the Russians will tell you you can't fly over Russia either. So the Russians are weaponizing this incredibly effectively. You know, it's very, very hard to get to Asia from Europe and indeed from parts of North America without flying over Russia. It causes much longer routings. But the fact that the Russians, as soon as Air France in particular, an Austrian, said, well, we will route our flights to avoid Belarus. And those were flights to Moscow. The Russians said, you don't fly over Belarus, you don't fly to Moscow at all. And Russia is inconveniently large and inconveniently sited. So this is going to make long haul, or this sort of behavior makes long haul a whole lot harder than it should be. And as a consequence of that, you know, this is why, as Richard pointed out, you know, the wide body recession, actually the wide body depression, is probably with us for this decade, because, you know, it's just got a ton harder.
Ron has got to leave us. Let me quickly ask him about the Boeing settlement, FAA $17 million penalty on 737 and then 787 suspended. Any thoughts on that, Ron, before you part?
Yeah, so just a couple quick thoughts. I mean, just on the previous subject, you know, not having an international way to share vaccine data, again, just kind of makes the whole international thing more complicated. So I would just add that thought onto what both Sasha and Richard were talking about. On the 787, the issue with the fabrication and the slowdown. I think that caught, you know, the market by surprise. Boeing had said that they would deliver the lion's share of the 787s that they have in inventory by the end of the year. Well, that clearly won't happen now. And then that begs the question, is, you know, five a stable production rate, or do they have to go down to four? Because they will have a lot of inventory they'll have to clear, and then kind of what liabilities are tied to it. And then finally, on the $17 million fine, I mean, come on. I mean, there's executives there who've made more than $17 million. So in terms of a fine, it doesn't seem like that's much of a fine, right? So that was just, I mean, not even a rounding error. So I don't know what, you know, that really means. I mean, the big picture, I mean, it's not much of a penalty. So there you have it.
Longer routing? I mean, how does that, is that effectively the leverage that's going to keep pretty much any bad guy from getting punished, especially if you're Russia? You've got to fly over my territory. Tough.
I mean, think about it. Part of the business case for the original 777, you know, the ultra long haul wide body twin, was the ability to overfly Russia, right? You got to do the polar routes, at least out of North America, if you want to get to Asia, right? So not having the ability to overfly Russia is a big deal, particularly for the North American market and the polar routes to Asia. I mean, that was one of the key building blocks of the whole wide body twin operating concept, right? So yeah, I mean, you know, Sash is 100% right. You absolutely can't avoid Russia, right? I mean, flying around Russia becomes, you know, not just, it's really untenable. I mean, it's very uneconomic.
Ron, thanks very much for joining us. All the best to your little fencers, and hope they have a great tournament.
Yeah, thanks, Fargo. Yeah, have a happy holiday.
Thanks a lot. Take care. Richard, I know you have one closing thought on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. The people who might have the geography that benefits from this is the Gulf Super Connectors, because, of course, if you go through Abu Dhabi, Dubai, or Doha, you know, you don't really have to go that way. You can get to Asia and go a totally different route. The advantage of going over Russia has always been from a nonstop flight perspective. And obviously that has resulted in some of the traffic being siphoned away from those Gulf Super Connectors, but maybe they can make a case that, hey, we can avoid Russia if you travel via our route instead, even if you have to change planes.
Speaking about Gulf Super Connectors, Akbar Al-Bakr, the CEO of Qatar Airways, has had a long-running feud with Airbus and gave Bloomberg a fascinating interview in which he cocked the shotgun and fired it again, was not specific on what the problem is. It's not an A381, right? The company has 10 380s, and they're going to resume. Half of them will go back into service, right? So we haven't seen the very end of the A380 yet for those people who want to enjoy the experience if long haul comes back. Do we have any sense what this spat is about, given that Qatar also has controlling stakes in IAG and other very important airlines? And he's, if I read the interview correctly, Richard, correct me if I'm wrong, like he said, like, we'll exercise our stake to punish Airbus unless we get satisfaction. And yet we don't know what satisfaction is about. And as a general rule, people look at Airbus and say, I'm pretty satisfied with their product and their service, right? I mean, so do we have any sense what this is about? Sash?
Yeah, it's nothing to do with A380. It's all about A350. Qatar is one of the biggest single customers for the A350, both the Dash 900 standard fuselage length and also the Dash 1000, actually, where I think they're the launch customer. They were the launch customer for the A350-900. And I'd be very, very surprised if that wasn't the cause of the dispute. I remember the original delivery of the very first A350, which was very nearly delayed over the year end as a result of Qatar making very, very similar comments to now. The response of the Airbus director responsible for the relationship is simply is unprintable. It's certainly not for the family viewing, but you know, I would see this as being negotiation. I suspect that Qatar wants to delay a delivery of a ton of A350s, and Airbus is saying, no way, Jose, and by the way, have you seen we're actually raising rates in 2 years' time so that we can deliver these things? And so he is, as he frequently does, going nuclear on this. And I think this, you know, he's a particularly aggressive airline CEO. The threat to use his stake to force other airlines to not to deal with Airbus is total bull. He just isn't powerful enough on those airline boards. You know, 25% does not give you that sort of rights with an airline like IAG. And that I would, you know, at best that is bluster. But I think he's negotiating to defer a ton of 350s.
Richard, very briefly, before we wrap up on Croatia and the Rafale and what it means or doesn't mean for the F-16. Go ahead, finish us off on this.
Yeah, you know, Sash sounds exactly right. The only thing I would add that, you know, sort of very quietly a month or two ago, Airbus signed an agreement extending Rolls-Royce's exclusivity on the 350 engine through the end of the decade. That's the only other possible thing that might be a point of contention if he was interested in introducing competition on the engine side. But it's just as likely that Sash is 100% correct, and it all comes down to capacity.
Last thoughts, each one of you get a brief shot at this, the significance of Dassault and France, I should say, selling the Rafale into Croatia. Obviously, the company has been on a run. Greece, more Egyptian orders. Sash, what's your sense on what all this means?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's only 12 aircraft. They're secondhand from the French Air Force, but the French Air Force look after their aircraft pretty well, so they'll be good aircraft when they're delivered. Why is it significant, though? The last three competitions, the Rafale has been up against the F-16 Block 60s/70s, quite often 70s, and it's killed them. And, you know, the Croatian competition was very interesting because you had secondhand Israeli F-16 Block 30s. They were apparently quite expensive to upgrade. You had brand new F-16 Block 70s from Lockheed Martin. And then you had secondhand Gripen CDs. Gripen CD would have been the economical choice. But actually, you know, secondhand Rafales, secondhand Rafales are just so much more capable than the Block 70. Clearly are being sold at very, very attractive prices. I think Rafale is becoming the, you know, the Viper killer at the moment in this in current market conditions.
Richard?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there are 128 Vipers on order. I'm not excited about a dozen used planes. Another thing to think about, of course, is that maybe the U.S. kind of shot itself in the foot because, of course, they played a role in stopping the transfer of the Israeli F-16s, presumably to give the new planes a shot at the market. But Croatia just isn't a market for used for new planes. It would prefer used. And then my final thought is that, you know, historically, French planes have been not all that great in terms of sustainment costs, and a twin-engine fighter is going to be even worse. That might be worth it if you're Greece and you really do need the planes for, you know, a lot of armed confrontations and whatever else, ditto for Egypt. But Croatia, they might just find they've got 12 planes that kind of turn into, hangar occupants and mission capable rates that are pretty darn low because they just don't have the budget for the proper levels of sustainment.
Although the French Air Force would tell you and even some American observers that the Rafale does have a pretty good availability rate, not quite as high as the Mirage, but still a pretty good availability rate.
Sure. But that's still a function of expense. You know, it's a question of budgeting. And if you're a country like Greece and you have the budget to make the planes operational, you can certainly do it. There's nothing at all wrong with the aircraft. It just tends to be expensive to operate, and the Croatians might not have properly budgeted for that.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a great what's left of Memorial Day. And I would commend to our audience to take a moment and remember the reason for this holiday, which is to remember those who've lost their lives in defense of the nation. Sash and Richard, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great week. Look forward to having you back on again next week.
Thanks so much, Vago.
Really appreciate it, Vago, and absolutely echoing your sentiments about Memorial Day.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.